Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I've got an audience of, get this, actual entrepreneurs. No, not the wannabes who are listening to this on NPR when they kind of feel like dropping out of their lives and seeing what it's like to be an entrepreneur. No, my audience is actual real entrepreneurs, ambitious upstarts, as I've said for years. All right. So most of us are in tech, and this is not going to shock us. When we go to websites and apps and web apps that we like and we create an account, it's actually not the company itself often that creates that login experience for us and manages it. Often, it's a company called Auth0 that creates it and makes sure that it's safe, secure, and easy to use. I didn't know much about this company. I've been using their forms for a long time. I had no idea they did it. I'm actually looking at one right now, and I don't see their name anywhere. They are the company behind the companies that you use. I invited the founder on here to talk about how he came up with this idea, how he got customers, what makes this business grow. His name is Eugenio Pace. He is the founder of Auth0. They are a universal authentication and authorization platform for developers of web, mobile, and legacy applications. Let's find out what this tool that helps the tools that we use grow is doing as a business. We can do that thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is the company that will help you hire great developers is called TopTal. And the second will help you hire great designers is called Design Crowd. This is the first time, by the way, Eugenio, that I'm wearing earphones in these interviews. I'm actually monitoring my audio from the mic. It's a little distracting, but if this is what's going to help me improve my audio quality, I'm up for it. Good to see you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Andrew.
I want to start off with revenue to just give people a sense of how big the company is. What's your revenue right now?
We don't disclose revenue, but we can tell you that we've been doubling our revenue every year and more for the last 5 years.
Here's what I have in my notes. Over $1 million in revenue.
Yeah, that's accurate.
But you're significantly more than that. You're just giving me like a small number. You are significantly more than that. Can you say how many like accounts have been created on your platform?
I can tell you how, you know, other metrics of the company. That can give you a hint of, you know, how big we are. So we are 400 employees in 36 different countries. We are a remote friendly company. We hire for talent. We don't hire for zip code or location. Sometimes we hire for time zone. But we have offices in Seattle. We have an office in London, in Sydney, in Tokyo, and in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Your home country.
Yes. I was born in Argentina many, many years ago, but I moved about 15 years ago. I moved to the States. I live in Seattle, in Washington State. I used to work for Microsoft. That was the reason.
And you guys have about $100 million in funding. Is that right?
Yes. We raised $110 million over 5 years.
No wonder when I say over $1 million in revenue, I saw like a little smile on your face. Like Andrew, it's like, yeah, Andrew, we've made our first dollar. Can you say if it's over 50 million?
I would say that it's closer to that number.
Closer to that number than the 1 million that we have here.
Yes.
Argentina, when you were born, was a dictatorship.
It
I got to get into business, but what was life like living in that environment back in the 70s?
You know, sometimes I look at my children. I have two boys. And when I think about the things that I was doing at their age, I could not imagine that. You know, it's like a completely different world. So I was born in 1970, to be precise. And, you know, the military dictatorship ended in 1983. So I was 13 years old when it finished. And in between, there was a war. There was a war between Argentinians, and there was a war with in the UK for two islands in the South Atlantic. It was very tough. You know, I was young, but I didn't realize, I guess my parents did a pretty good job in, you know, providing like a safe environment for me. But, you know, I grew up like, to give you an example of what it looked like, you know, the best place for me to ride my bicycle was in the place where the president lived. And at that time, I was a general, right? And so the reason it was great to ride my bicycle there is because all the streets were closed and you couldn't go with your car in there. So it was like all for me to ride my bike.
And still, two doors down from your house, a bomb went off, right?
Wow, we are well informed.
Yes. The thing that gets me is you have said that that environment, being in Argentina, growing up there, made you an entrepreneur, helped you be more entrepreneurial. I'm wondering how.
Well, you learn to be resilient. And I'm not sure if it's just the situation that the country was in there, but it's a, you know, Argentina was a place with scarcity. Not a lot of resources. There was no, like, easy, you know, looking back, there was no capital or the resources to learn. It was like more restricted in many, many ways. So one of the skills that you learn is to find your way around. When you really like something or really want something, you learn that obstacles are just things that are there to test how much you want those things, not to prevent from getting those.
Okay, so losing a customer is not the end. Having somebody say no to you is not the end. Oh, and by the way, you have reached out to so many people when Auth0 was just getting started to get clients. I think most people would have been way too wussy to have done as much as you did. But let me build up to it by first asking you about Microsoft. What were you doing at Microsoft for about 10 years?
Yeah, so I joined Microsoft in the field. I was a consultant. So Microsoft had an organization called Microsoft Consulting Services. It was essentially a professional services arm, right? So I joined Microsoft Argentina in 2000. I survived the Y2K. And when everything was still up and running, I changed my job. I was working in a bank before that. I joined Microsoft in consulting. I stayed there for a couple of years. And then one of my projects took me here to Redmond. I was doing a project in the UK, in Spain, in Central America, and the US. And one of those, one of those trips, the team that I was working with offered me a job. And so I joined originally for 3 years, and I was a program manager in the engineering team. I was in the developer division. So always working in things related to developers, always around making developers productive.
And one of those tools was going to take on a piece of Amazon. What was that?
That was Microsoft Azure. So Microsoft Azure, which eventually became Microsoft Azure, was Microsoft's cloud computing offering. And my project, of course, I was one of many, many hundreds of professionals working in that space. But my project was about identifying anything that would prevent developers from adopting this new paradigm, right? So when you're building software that is not running in your premises, that it's managed by a third party, there's many, you know, friction points.
Like what? What are some of the friction points before we get to the one that you discovered that led you to Auth0? What are some of the ones?
Wasn't the number one, right? That was the very first.
But let's build to it. Give me just a sense of some of the obstacles, and then we'll get into the biggest one.
Well, you know, it really depends on the level of abstraction that you're coding against, right? So we take a dependency to core infrastructure. Well, you know, that's kind of easier because the common denominator is, you know, your servers. You don't have a server anymore. You have a virtual machine that is somewhere else, that it might not have the exact characteristics of the machines that you were used to working, right?
Yeah.
But another perfect example of a developer-centric, you know, view of those obstacles is built-in limitations of the cloud, right? Like latency and bandwidth. And being aware of, you know, the fact that you are always going across a network that happens to be internet. There's no like private connections. There's no dedicated lines. And so when you build software that it was all meant to be in low latency environments, you know, now you put it in the cloud and it's going to be slow. You're going to have pages that take forever to load. You build chatty applications. If your application have dependencies with internal resources, then now you're going to a website hosted in the cloud that it comes back to your own data center. It's performance and experience.
You know what? This is kind of a small example, but I lived in Argentina when we started Mixergy. I couldn't get access to random things, like I couldn't use PayPal randomly, or I couldn't buy a book on Amazon. Most books you could buy anywhere, but there'd be some book I wanted to buy, I couldn't buy it. So I would just go and fire up a server on Amazon's computers, log in through the browser to Amazon or PayPal or whatever I needed that was in the US. So finally they said, okay, you're good. I'd get what I wanted. Then I'd close it down and walk away. But it was a little bit frustrating, even though I'm just typing in Amazon.com, to not have the keys instantly hit and show up on my screen, to not be able to hit enter and instantly show up. Small issue. That's the type of thing you're talking about. But those are smaller compared to the number one obstacle that people who are trying to build on Microsoft's cloud came up against, which was?
Identity management, authentication.
Why? Give me an example of how that would come up. Why would identity management be such an issue for Microsoft potential customers and existing customers?
Well, to begin with, because the traditional architecture in the Microsoft world was to have Active Directory, right? So all applications were built around Active Directory. All Microsoft products, the development stack, all of that was heavily centered around AD.
I have to admit, I don't know what that is. Can you give me an example with like, what was a potential customer that my audience of software entrepreneurs would identify with that then had a trouble with identity management?
So any company with any business really using Microsoft products. So if you're a bank or if you're a insurance company, virtually any company that was running an IT shop, and if it was Microsoft, of course, they would be running Active Directory. Active Directory is, in essence, a database of usernames and credentials, right? So okay. Username and passwords. AD, Active Directory, is precisely that. It's a directory of users. Microsoft gave you everything to connect all the systems to Active Directory. Everything was centered around.
So if I created my own project management software to sell to end users, I wouldn't have to keep track of all the users who are using it. I would just use Microsoft's desktop software, AD.
Yes.
Got it.
You just use AD, which was, you know, permanently connected and very intimately connected with Windows. So if you were building Windows-based software, even further, all those things will be taken care of.
Okay, got it. And I could focus on the checklist. I could focus on project progress, et cetera. And so you were noticing that people had this issue. Let me ask you this then. Why didn't you say, hey, listen, Microsoft, I got our killer new feature. We want more people to use this. You've tasked me with finding more ways to get people to use this. Here's our big obstacle. Let's add this on.
Yeah, so the first step in that journey was actually to write a book about the problem. So I wrote one book that was published by Microsoft that was called A Guide to Claims-Based Identity and Access Management. And it was a book about like, you know, maybe half an inch in width.
I have to say, I'm looking at the cover for this. This definitely looks like not a general consumer-based book cover. This looks like, like a research paper with a nice cover on it.
Very much so.
By the way, one of your books is selling. It's so rare. It's selling for $821 on Amazon. I looked it up.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So you wrote a book on this. Microsoft published it. Claims-based identity. You said, okay, we're going to teach people. We're going to solve it that way.
Yes. And so that's how we started. We said, like, let's publish guidance. Let's publish all the patterns. It was published by a team that I was part of. It was called Patterns and Practices. What we did is capture this, you know, common, you know, blessed designs, if you will. And so that book was this size and it covered, you know, important patterns for websites, for, you know, different use cases and different scenarios. A year later, I went back to my boss at that time and I said, like, look, you know, we keep uncovering things in this space. There's even more patterns. There's even more things that we need to do. And so I got the funding to write the second edition of the same book. And this time was like double the size. And that was the epiphany. Because I figured, well, you know, we can keep writing about the problem, expecting developers to translate our words, our diagrams, our findings into runtime, into actual code. Mm-hmm. How about we just, you know, build a service that does it? And people will not have to become experts on anything in this. I mean, they can become experts if they want
to. And did you go to Microsoft and say, hey, you guys should do this?
No.
No. You said, I think I've got this.
I think I got this. I knew Microsoft. I was there for a long time. And I knew how it worked. And I imagine that it would take a long time to, you know, launch something like this. And so I saw a faster path to making this available to everyone. you know, if I did this on my own. I also have to confess, I always wanted to build a company. And so, you know, I saw the opportunity and we did it.
Okay. And then there are two fantastic stories that I can't wait to bring up. One, you did something with your wife that I don't think anybody that I've interviewed has ever done with their wife. And number two, this crazy story, not crazy, but this thing that happened that you actually have on tape that I want to bring up. But first, I've got to tell everyone about a company called Design Crowd. I thought I ran their last ad, but it looks like I've got a few more. Guys, these guys are not re-upping their ads with me for next year. I think I've let them down, probably because they don't charge that much, and I do, right? So if I charge a lot, they have to get a lot of customers to, and I didn't get them enough customers. But here's the thing with Design Crowd. You're going to love this. Are you a designer, by the way?
No,
me neither. It kind of makes me uncomfortable even to think about how to articulate what I want from my design.
Yep.
So what Design Crowd does is they said, you know what? We're going for non-designers. Let's make it super simple. Just two fields. Make it simple. By the time they've answered those two fields, we've gotten them in the process and it's so easy that they articulate to us what they want. And then don't worry about it, guys. Yeah, they do ask a few more questions if you want to go in there and add more depth. They say, don't worry about it. We're going to send this out to a crowd of designers. And I did that. I needed a logo for people who are certified by one of our educational programs. I said, here's what I like. Here's what I don't like. I took what some of our students said they like and don't like. I sent it out. Boom. I end up with dozens and dozens of designs from people all over the world. And I gave them feedback. And then they adjusted. And then I get a flood of more designs. I gave them feedback. I got more. And I ended up paying for and picking only the one that I loved. And I gave that to our graduates. And now I see they put it on their websites. They go to events. They put it on their slides. One of them, Stephen Braden, has that on all his email going out because he's proud of it. And I'm proud of it because it looks so good. If you are not a designer and you need beautiful design, go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy. It looks like they do have a couple more ads with me before the end of the year. They didn't re-up for next year. I will go down dying saying that this service is the best design choice I've ever made. It is so good. Designcrowd.com/Mixergy. They'll give you a big discount when you use that URL. Designcrowd.com/Mixergy is also where you will see my design and my beautiful photo. All right, see my design, get one for yourself. I love them. All right, and by the way, if they don't charge enough, how? Some of my sponsors, we have to sit them down and say, charge more, do good work. All right, the first thing that you did was, you, or one of the first things, you went to an entrepreneur wannabe group in Seattle. Do you remember this? And what did you do there?
Well, I was like thinking about building a company, and I, to my wife's credit, that was my wife's idea. She said,
go to this group.
She's like, you don't know anything about building companies. You're a great engineer, but, you know, why don't you go and join this? You know, I found this thing and they teach you how to do things. You know, they teach you how to create a company, how to start up. And so I did. And I went, and it was really a good program. It was intense. There was a lot of new things. It was a little bit of like a, you know, like those TV shows that you're like kicked off after a while.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was like a reality thing. Not exactly, but you were supposed to do things with a cadence and you were supposed to present and you were supposed to, you know, achieve certain milestones by certain dates. And you would be essentially selected in or out on each of those. So you were filtering out fewer and fewer people until the very few that made it to the end, they would essentially get like seed fund or something to get started. And by then, the idea was you would have, you know, a good pitch deck, you would have a business plan, you would have like a good understanding of your customer base, your value proposition, not necessarily running code, but something more or less more structured, right?
And then what happened when you presented? They love it?
Well, you have the audio, right? So I didn't resign. I didn't quit. That was one of the things that I learned in Argentina, is like never quitting. But I was kicked out, of course, naturally.
Because of what? And by the way, they recorded this for you? They actually did this in front of other people? And they recorded?
So you were supposed to present with other people that were, you know, all other like peers to me, like they were doing the same thing. And so you presented to mentors and advisors, you know, people that were you know, already either successful entrepreneurs or they were like entrepreneurs that exited their business, etc. Industry, there were also companies there anyway. So there was like a judge, you know, this panel of judges. And so the exact word, they will tape you. And so you would get the feedback afterwards. You could read it, you could listen to it and perfect your pitch. So I gave my pitch on Auth0 or something very close to Auth0 back then. And this was one of the final one, right? So, but then it was like a little bit more polished. And I remember this judge's words. It was, I have good news and I have bad news for you. The good news is that this is a massive problem. And it's like a massive market. There's like millions and millions of dollars to be made if you solve this problem. Now, the bad news is that I don't see you doing this. You, specifically you, doing this. And, you know, and that was it. You know, that's after
Why?
That.
What was it that you were lacking? You were a guy who worked at Microsoft with developers. You wrote the book on this before, right? What was it that you were lacking?
Well, you know, I don't remember the exact specifics. I think part of the his concern was that it was like a massive problem that cannot be solved with, you know, with a small investment. Mm. I think he believed that it was, you know, something that the Googles of the world, the Microsoft of the world would be able to do, but not a startup, right? And, you know, like I am the, you know, this, somebody told me once, there's three types of people. People that see the glass half full, people that see the glass half empty, and people that are happy that there's a glass. And I'm on that category, right? So I am the eternal optimist, and I'm already happy that there's a glass. And I took I have good news for you, and I really wanted to do this.
So you just walked away not thinking, hey, I'm a loser who can't pull this off, and even a smart guy told me to give up. You said, hey, this is a multi-million dollar opportunity. We could be big. All right. So then you went to your wife. You had a conversation with her. And did you sign a contract with her?
I did.
What was in this? Do you guys sign contracts a lot?
This was the biggest one, I would say. The scariest one. Okay, the one that I had to yield on many.
What was this contract about, and then what did you have to yield?
So the contract was the conditions of starting the business.
Okay.
And the you know, the conditions for ending it too. And so it was like, you're going to do this for 1 year. So I have 1 year to prove that this was, you know, working. I had to generate revenue in, I think it was 6 months or so. So she gave me 1 year and some revenue for 6 months or so. The third condition was that if at the year it didn't work out, there was no waiver. There was no like,
renegotiation.
Oh, I have another idea. It's not like identity, but it's something else. So it's done. You go back and work for Microsoft or for somebody else. And then there was a fourth condition, which was around moving back to Argentina. So she didn't want to move to Argentina. I didn't want either. But she said, like, well, if it doesn't work out, then we have to, you know, if you find a job in Argentina or family support, you know, our kids are growing up here, the friends are here, they're like, you know, they're 10 years old and 12 years old. We cannot afford to break their lives. So we will not move back to Argentina. And I signed the contract.
This is very personal, but as a guy who'd worked for so many years at such a big company, you didn't have years and years and years of money in the bank?
No. Well, you know, being rich is not about how much you have. It's about how much you need, right? So my more personal situation is that one of my sons has special needs, and so he goes to special education, and you know, our expenses with him are pretty high, and I wanted to support that, but you know, I could fund the adventure for 1 year for us without making any significant changes in in our life, and especially in our life, you know, for him. And so we wanted to provide the same level of education, support, and training and therapies that he goes to. And so I could do that for a year. That's where the year comes from.
Matthias Woloski is your co-founder?
Yes.
How did you guys connect?
So Matthias worked for my team as a vendor in Microsoft. So he was not a Microsoft employee, but the company that he founded,
Southworks,
he was one of the co-founders. I hired that company to help me produce some of our content, our software, and he was actually one of the co-authors of the book on identity management that I told you about before.
Okay, so he was your co-founder. He was in Argentina. He did not want to move to the U.S. You and your wife did not want to go to Argentina. You said, you know what? Let's just do this as a remote team. You decided to go as a remote team. How long did it take you to build the first product, the first version?
It took us about 3 months to build the very first, like, publishable thing.
How did you do in 3 months what this investor with all his background said a Google could only start accomplishing this?
Well, we maybe took a naive approach to the problem. You know, we looked, the situation forced us to look at the problem from a very, very different angle. And from an angle of, you know, first of all, with a developer angle, which is a unique angle. Second, with an angle of not trying to make everybody an expert on identity. So removing everything and make it like dead simple for developers to use our software. From day one, we focused a lot on usability, on documentation, on, you know, design and experience. And so we make it really, really, really easy. We were inspired by companies like Stripe, like Twilio, like SendGrid. Those are like, you know, companies that we look up to in terms of same audience, different domain, of course, but same audience, similar approach.
Because with like SendGrid, which recently sold to Twilio, speaking of those two companies, for $2 billion, they said, we want to make it easy for app makers to send out email from their apps. All they have to do is just make these one or two little changes and then boom, the thing just works. I remember the founder, Isaac, was on here talking about how simple he wanted to make it. He said, we want to do the same thing. So simple takes a long time to get right. I wonder if it's also that you guys decided, I'm looking at some notes from the beginning of the company. You said, we're going to make people's apps work with Office 365, Google Apps, and Active Directory on single sign-on. You kept it kind of simple that way, right?
Yeah. So we you know, if you look at the product in those first three months, it was really, really small, and it was ambitious in the design and in the developer experience, but it was very, you know, narrowed down the scope to just a few use cases. So a few use cases to prove the point that we were doing.
So I couldn't, if I was an app maker, say, hey, you know what? I like Google Apps, but my people are really big on Twitter. I need to let them log in with Twitter. You would have said, I can't help you. Yeah. Maybe in the future. I can't do it now. Okay, so that was part of it, limiting the scope. 3 months in, and plus you've got that 12-month agreement with your wife that's ticking, ticking, ticking. Yes. Did you leave Microsoft before that ticking started? Okay, so you left it. You're fully in there. You get that first version going. And I mentioned earlier, now you've got to start selling. You became the big salesman of the company. You started to do things like reach out to, here's what it says. I reach out to every single person in my network. I spoke with hundreds of people. And you had a network because of what? Your book, because of working at Microsoft, all the Microsoft clients?
Definitely. My work at Microsoft was somewhat public, you know, and so I had like, I was speaking at conferences. I was, you know, published author.
Yep.
These are not the two only books that we wrote. You know, we had other publications in the space. So I was relatively not a celebrity or anything, but I was well known. I was respected. I had a career. I have like, you know, 13 years of building software, helping people build software. And so, you know, I tapped into that, right? And yes, I spoke with hundreds of people and I got like tons of no's. You know, another lesson I would say for, you know, other people considering something similar is that your you know, you might think like, you know, being in a big company that you're like all this power.
No.
But the minute that you're outside and the people don't recognize the domain anymore in your email, you say, oh yeah, I replied to your email before, but I'm not going to reply now. You know, who are you? So there's a little bit of that.
You went from being able to send email to people from an at microsoft.com email address to an at outlook.com email address. And that's, am I right? Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a change.
Got it. Okay, yeah, but still, every single person who you could, you would reach out to them, you would follow up with them, you'd offer them a freemium model, which at the time had just free. I don't think you had the premium. You didn't have the premium version, right?
No, not at the beginning.
Not at the beginning.
One of the key things that we did was to focus on developers and where they flocked, right? So everywhere where there was developers, we were there.
For example?
We were in Stack Overflow. We were in forums. Answering questions.
What's your username on Stack Overflow? How do I find your old post there?
Eugenia P.
That's it.
Eugenia P. or Eugenia Pace? Pretty sure. One of those.
Stack Overflow. And that was you personally sitting down saying, yeah, I got to respond to everybody. Oh, I see. Exactly. It's Eugenia Pace.
Yeah. That's me.
You've got 11,898 reputation. 11,000. That's a lot of people loving and hating your stuff. Here's one of your answers. What's the difference between the two workflows when you use authorization code flow? Here's another one. Is it better to have many small Azure storage blob containers, each with some blobs, or one really large container with tons of blobs? That was from 2011.
Yeah.
So this is sitting down. Got it. Okay. I want to talk about your very first customer, a guy named Robert, but let me first talk about my sponsor, a company called TopTal. Let me ask you this. As a guy who's worked with a lot of developers, if someone is listening to me, Eugenio, and wants to hire a developer, what tip do you have for them for hiring the right developer? Oh, it's so tough.
One of our best practices is to, you know, inquire on culture fit. So that's one of the traits. We want people that embrace remote as well. So their location is not as important. And the last thing we do, which we really like, and it's been a predictor of success in our company, is what we call the exercise. The exercise is not a traditional, you know, brain teaser. I don't believe in any of those. It's not the coding exercise on the whiteboard. We give people a small assignment in written. And you can take that home, do it on your own, and then present it to us.
Because what are you looking for with that?
Because we're trying to look into how people operate in the real world. You know, an interview, it's such a unnatural setting.
Right. To come up with an answer on the spot is not the way most people do it. No, yes, salespeople do, but the rest of the company does not have to answer on the spot.
And
that's what you want. You want to see, how do they Google? How do they find the answer? How do they come to their conclusion? Got it. Okay. Well, that's good advice. For anyone out there who's looking to hire, that's one of the things you could absolutely do with TopTal. When you go to TopTal, you tell them exactly what you're looking for, the type of person you want, the culture that you're working in, number of hours. Do you want a full-time team of people? Do you want a part-time person? Anything in between? And then they'll find them for you, and you get on a call with them, and you can often hire them within a couple of days. They could get started. One of my past interviewees, Derek Johnson, heard me say this so many times. He must have just gone, I'm tired of Andrew talking about this. But you know what? He and his CTO were trying to actually find people. They did 20 to 30 interviews looking for this one type of person. They waited and looked and wasted their CTO's time and wasted Derek's time. And then they finally said, all right, let's just try this TopTal thing that Andrew's talking about. So they get on with TopTal, and when you, whoever's listening to me, and frankly, you, Eugenio, or anyone who you're investing in, now that you're doing so well, you've actually got a new CEO running your company. So maybe the next company that you advise is looking to hire someone. You're all going to do the same thing. You're going to hit a button and basically schedule a call with someone, a human being at TopTal. He did that. He told them what they were looking for. TopTal then brought in two people. They said either one of them they could have hired. They found the one that they felt right with. That person now is a full-timer at their company. They've hired more since then. But here's the key. His CTO said to Derek, this guy you hired from TopTal, he could basically be CTO instead of me. That's how good they are at TopTal. So if you're out there and you're looking to hire, go to toptal.com/mixerg. When you go there, you're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period. Guys, go to top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, TOPTAL.com/Mixergy. Robert, first customer, how did he find you?
Robert, at that time we had like an online chat on a website, which I was monitoring, as you can imagine. Like
you were monitoring
24/7.
Of course, yeah. It's you, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. And so somebody pops up in the website in the chat, said, "Hey, I have a few questions here and there." And so I offered like a Skype connect. Let me call you. We'll tell me more. Every opportunity I had to talk to people trying to use our service, I took, and Robert was one of them, and he was like super excited. He wanted to learn everything. He wanted to, he asked us for 20 feature requests. They were like, it was awesome. And so, but at one point, he said something like, "Look, I love it. I want to be a customer. I don't think we even have pricing by then." And he said, like, "No," he insisted, "I want to pay for this. This is so good that, removes so much of my troubles that I want to pay for you." And so, anyway, we were like, we came up with a price, and he became our first paying customer in, I think it was April 2013.
You know, so I have a note
within the window that I had in my contract.
Oh, with your contract, so this was revenue that counted.
Of course,
this is like not even that much revenue. Can I say what the revenue was?
You can.
You said to him, "I don't know. How about if we charge you $50?" He said, I'm running a small company. 50 is too much for me." You negotiated to $27, but that was enough for you with your contract with your wife.
That was enough. I mean, you can imagine the conversation that we had that night, right? So I said, look, I have a first paying customer.
Yeah.
So it's somebody that is like, signing a check. And she asked, how much? And I said, it's $27 per month. And she looked at me and said, "Are you going to get more of those?" And I said, "Yes, this is the first one of many."
I'm very proud that I am a first customer of many people's books and software products. The most famous one is probably, ManyChat, first customer of ManyChat, first customer of Zapier. It is the best to be the first customer because, first of all, you're never forgotten. You remember Robert's name. And second, yeah, you get direct access to these people who are going to basically start to build things based on what you need.
Yeah.
All right. So you had your first customer, and then here's what you told our producer. We started reaching out to developers that were the purchasing influencers of large organizations. You started to get really systemized, it seems like, early days. But can you talk a little bit about that and how the book, The New Kingmakers, fits in with this part of your story?
Yeah. So the underlying premise of our company is that every company in the world is a software company. It's very much in line with, there's a very famous essay that was written by Marc Andreessen. It's called something like this, software is eating the world.
That's it. They actually have that on Andreessen Horowitz's website. I don't know if they still do as their logo. Software, yes, is eating the world.
A16. Software is eating the world. And it's this premise that, every company is a software company. I like to use the analogy of, our family runs a dairy farm in Argentina. And I like to think about them as being, it's just a software company that produces milk. But everything is run by software. The food, their, the way cows are treated, their reproduction, everything is software. And so, 2 years later, after that essay came out, this book came out, The New Kingmakers.
Let me read the subtitle. It's How Developers Conquered the World.
Right.
Really gives you a sense of it. Uh-huh.
And so it's about this notion that, because everything is run by software, anything that makes software developers more productive, build better software, more secure, more robust, better in all sense, it's going to be attractive in the world. Mm-hmm. That's us, right? So our whole premise is that we serve developers. Now, developers, perhaps like Robert, they are building software for themselves. They're running their own company. They're like entrepreneurs on their own. But a big chunk of the developers of the world are working for another company. They're working in oil and gas. They're working in insurance companies, in banks and whatnot. And more, they have become the decision makers. They become like the purchasing agent in a way. They don't have the budget, but they go to the boss and they say, look, I can spend the next 3 months building identity, building authentication and the authorization infrastructure for this app, or you can give me this budget and I can go and have that done in 2 days. And I can spend all these 3 months building our software.
Got it.
What makes us unique. That's the value proposition.
And then how are you going to find these people who are the deciders within companies?
And it's content, content, content.
That was it.
All we do is, and it's not easy, of course, but I invite you to do an experiment. Go to open a browser and type authentication LDAP iOS, right? So the three keywords that you would typically use to, build iOS application connecting with LDAP, which is a protocol for identity and, authentication. And if you worked on your browser, you would see that the first link, it's us.
Yeah, I did it. And the first link was you. And the second link was Stack
Overflow. And that's not an advertisement, right? So that's real content. So that's tutorials, it's quick starts, it's
but
tools.
But this was the way you got the next batch of customers? The first batch was you reaching out to people.
Yep.
Guys like Robert coming to your website because they're searching for this tool and signing up.
Searching.
But the next batch of customers,
Stack Overflow, et cetera.
Right, Stack Overflow. That's where the first group of people came in.
Mm-hmm.
Freemium, I think. Do you still have freemium? I know you had it for a long time.
I do, yeah.
Okay. The freemium back in 2014, for example, that I'm looking at said one application, 100 social users, 50 users with passwords, okay, and 10 enterprise users to give me a sense of what you were offering for free. People would try it out and then they would sign up. But it was you writing the content in the beginning?
Yeah.
It was.
So blog posts and, remember, I had some experience in writing.
Because of the book.
And producing content for developers. So I figured I had like some, skills I could tap into. Over time, of course, we hired and we invested in content people. So we have technical writers and we have developers that all they do is produce content for developers to help them with the common challenges.
But you're still doing this because writing is its own. It takes a lot of time. Talking to customers takes a lot of time. Product envisioning takes a lot of time. And you were doing all this
in the beginning, of course, in a much smaller scope than what we do today. But yes, I was doing. Matthias was very much focused on producing the software and designing the service and running the service. So he was essentially running engineering, product management, operations, security. And I was doing everything else, everything that was customer facing, selling, everything that was support.
Chatting. Then in 2014, Bessemer Venture Partners put in $2.4 million. Was that you going after them?
So at the end of 2013, we knew that we were onto something because by then we had another second customer. The second customer is a big insurance company. And so the first customer was Robert, single developer. The second customer was hundreds of thousands of dollars of a deal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For a big corporation. Again, a developer that found us. And then they say, oh, this is great. We can use it here. It's going to allow us to move faster. We signed a deal with them. It took, of course, much longer. But I had the proof point. I have like a single developer and I have a big enterprise.
And this big enterprise, were they comfortable working with a company that had no funding and whose founder had a contract with his wife saying he might have to close up shop?
Yes. So we built like the provisions in the contract with them.
Okay.
To, accommodate the risk. And of course, it was a really good deal for them as well. Because, at that time, we were really, really able to deliver for them something that was outstanding. With squarely to what they needed, and we accelerated a number of features for their use case, right?
So he was hiring you kind of as like a contract developer, kind of as a software vendor.
But we gave them a product, right? So yes, we were like accommodating a lot of their requirements, but we did it in a way that we packaged that as a service, as a product, and so we were lucky too. I'm not going to you know, luck, it's a big component of any successful startup.
They could have come a few months later.
But they knew me personally. Yep. So I knew them from previous lives. They knew me personally, and the commitments we delivered, everything we promised we delivered. And they're still a customer. Both of them are still a customer, 4 or 5 years later. Now, we have the proof point. Big company, this revenue,
yes.
You know, in six-digit revenue, but all this developer love. And so at that time, I should say I was the CEO of the company, but I wanted to focus and I wanted to grow the company fast. And so we hired a CEO in 2014 with the goal of helping us accelerate what are the building blocks for the company. So I decided we hired somebody I knew in the role of CEO, primarily looking at funding. I was going to look after customers and Matthias was going to look after the service. And so we raised $800,000. So that this new person helped us, you know, through that transition. He led the first fundraise. So we raised $800,000 from angels and small investors. And then Bessemer, that was like that was also fantastic, you know, that happened to us because for many reasons. One is that, I pitched to tens of VCs by then. So not in 2013, but in 2014, I pitched to tens of VCs. And Bessemer was the one actually that gave us the book, The New Kingmakers. And you say like, you guys are this. That's why we want to be in. And they were investors in Twilio. I believe they were investors in many developer companies like Twilio. And so they say like, we believe in this model. We think that this is a great way of, you know, selling software, selling services. So we believe in you. They are typically a later stage investor. They will only do Series A investments. So that's, you know, once you go over $1 million in revenue, typically. But I guess they liked us. And so they overall was, you know, $2.4 million in 2014. And then 2015, we raised Series A, Series B, the following year. So every year we've been doing like another series.
How hard was it to raise money? Was it just not your focus? You were still focused on customers and...
No, I was involved, but it was not led by me in those years. I led the latest round, which happens to be the biggest one. So the Series D, which happened this year, I did it because I am the CEO now.
You're the CEO now again?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that you became the CEO again. What was that like to step back into that role?
It was great. It was, you know, somewhat difficult, but, you know, I am super grateful to John, our previous CEO. So he led the company from 2014 to 2017. And, you know, he was great. In that sense, you know, he built like the foundations of the company, and then he was leading the fundraise. You know, I was part of the same roadshow with him, right? But he was his experience and background was in M&A. He was he was a VC himself before, and so you know he had a lot of experience of how that.
Looking at his experience, he was at Intel Capital.
Yeah.
He was Intel Capital. Senior investment manager there. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So he knew how to do that very, very well.
And he was at Microsoft around the time that you were there and you guys had other places where you interacted.
Yes. And so, you know, it was great. But, you know, building a company is more than fundraising. It's and you know we're at the stage now where other things are also important, and
I felt that it was. What's the big thing that's drawing you back? It's no longer blogging and going into Stack Exchange daily. What's the job like that's so exciting? There we go. I lost you there for a second. I thought the whole computer froze up. Sorry, you were saying what was exciting about the job right now?
So there's a couple of things that I spend all my time on. So I stepped in the role back in December 2017. So I've been here for, you know, 11 months or so in this new role. back again in this new role, the new old role. And my focus right now, it's on culture, it's on company, it's on team, it's on product as well, but more, you know, in the strategy and, you know, what, where we need to take the company, where we want to be in the next 5 years.
When you work on culture, what does that mean for you? How are you thinking about culture?
So I'm pretty, you know, hardcore on that, because I believe that if you don't take care of the culture, one culture will emerge in your organization. And it might not be necessarily the one you want, right? You know, I always struggle a little bit with work and life balance, because for me, I always like picture that as two separate things, you know, my work and my life, where in reality is more like a Venn diagram where work is a subset of your life. It's inside your life. And so I want to work in a place that doesn't suck. You know, I want to build a company that it's, you know, an enjoyable thing.
And so what does enjoyable mean for you?
Enjoyable means that we're doing things that are meaningful, that have a purpose, where I feel that I'm learning, where I feel I'm contributing, where I feel I'm making a difference. And I believe that all our employees, you know, the people that we attract have the same inner fire, you know, they want to do something meaningful. They want to do something impactful. They want to learn. They are learners. They are people that want to grow. And I want to build a company that when you look back, you know, years in your career, whether it's within a zero or not, I want people to look at that and say, like, that was a time in my life where that I remember with, you know, with great memories.
Because of what? Because they learned more, because they did
because of
more
growth, than they thought they... Because of what they learned, because of what they were able to do and achieve.
So I'm looking at what seems like your list of company philosophy, the points that you guys stand for. One of them is we're obsessed with discovering customer value. We trust and respect each other. We hold ourselves to higher standards, et cetera. How does like we are passionate, for example, express itself? How do you know that you're actually living that one? Or what do you do to make sure that you live these items here that you guys put together in an offsite?
Yeah. So we codified our values, you know, at the beginning of the year. The version that you're reading, you know, the new ones, we codify a lot of things. So part of the culture was defining those elements. Mm-hmm. Our culture has, the backbone of our culture is built around four elements. One is our values. The other one is our promises to our customers. The third one is mission and vision, which are more classic, I guess. But passion in particular shows up in many, many ways. You know, it shows up in, you know, perhaps a better title for that would be like, you know, this sweep the floors concept, right? Yeah. Which is nothing it's somebody else's work or problem in Auth0. When somebody has a problem, a customer has a problem, you know, you will see people jumping in to help and to do well for the customer, to put them back in a good place, regardless of their jobs.
Do you have an example of how you guys have done that, or have you done that?
A few. You know, there was, you know, recently a customer that deployed their solution. They made use of, you know, of our platform that was not really scalable, and it wasn't the best way of deploying our system. And so, you know, they launched and it was not working as expected or to the levels that they were expecting. And it was a little bit of a scramble because it was, you know, limited. It was on Friday, the classic, right?
Yep.
We don't work on weekends. We don't work overtime. We don't believe in that. We don't believe in 70 hours week works or week long works. We don't believe in any of that. But in this time, we had a customer. He was in trouble. We had to help them. It wasn't necessarily our fault, but it was our problem, right? Because they were like saying, well, what should we do? And we have people from our professional services team, from engineering, from support, from all professions jumping in. We assembled a SWAT team to fix everything for them. And we did it.
Okay.
Then came Monday and they were live. And they're a happy customer now.
All right, I get it. I'm so I feel like at some point, all entrepreneurs end up having to deal with culture more so than all the stuff that they got into entrepreneurship for. And I see more and more entrepreneurs that I talk to geek out on it. Like this thing that they didn't think would be fun is now a passion project. And I want to ask more and more about it. All right. So, and by the way, I interviewed this guy here. He sent me his book. I said, you didn't have to send me your book. This is Scott Bintz. He talked about how he built this truck part and pickup truck part business, got it up to $100 million in sales, largely because of culture. He was stuck at like $3 or $5 million, couldn't actually get beyond it, got culture to work, and then suddenly the people built up his business. Fantastic story. Anyway, I've been seeing that more and more. I invited him to do a course on Mixergy. I'll talk more about that with you guys later. But I want to thank you so much for being on here. Eugenio, for anyone who wants to check out your website, you're like on all the social networks also. Like I'm looking at you guys on Dribbble. I don't know why you guys need to be on Dribbble, but I see a bunch of interesting designs and like the logo design. You're everywhere.
We are.
So go check them out on dribbble.com/auth0, or just go to auth0.com if you want to check them out. And I want to thank my two sponsors for making this happen. The first will help you guys find phenomenal designers. Go check them out at designcrowd.com/mixergy for a big discount. And the second will help you hire phenomenal developers. It's called TopTal. Check them out at toptal.com/mixergy. Eugenio, thanks for sticking around a little later than we expected with me, and I appreciate you doing this interview.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And congrats on doing more than $1 million.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Bye, everyone.